You are listening to the Pacifica Radio Archives weekly series, From the Vault.
About writers, I sort of feel like stopping now. It's not speaking, but writing. It's interesting about when writers feel like stopping. It's, yeah, hell, I don't give a damn if another book by me ever comes out. And a good friend out at Iowa was Vance Bourgeli. And I asked him about it. He and I are about the same age. And he said, yeah, he thought he could quit now. And not feel too bad about it. He could quit. There wasn't that inner necessity anymore to write. But he also said he could. And Nelson Algren was out there at the same time teaching, and Nelson said at that time, and he may have changed his mind now, that he didn't think he had another book in him. And Vance Bourgeli said, hell, I've always got another book in me. You know, I can always think of one, but maybe I just won't write it. But he was upset that Nelson said there wasn't anything more inside of him. There is a lot more inside of Nelson, I guess, because he's published considerable since then. I've heard that a writer is lucky because he cures himself every day with his work. And that's right, except that I cured myself, not that the book was important to anybody else, but the last book, Slaughterhouse-Five, was important to me for some reason, which remains uncoded. I'm turned off now. I'm not strongly motivated to write another book. Another crazy thing happened. I changed from right-handed to left-handed. And I called my brother about this, and I said, Jesus, I never heard this about, you know, maybe I was left-handed, and he's 10 years older than I am. He said, yeah, you were ambidextrous. Well, after I finished that book and got $71,000, I turned into a southpaw. As my relatives in Indianapolis don't like the dirty words in my book, and they think I do that because if you put a dirty word in a book, there's people will buy a lot more copies because it's so exciting to certain low types of people. As my mother-in-law was with me for the last 2 weeks, and I finally got her to talk about it some, and it was very unpleasant. She had told me this. It brought messages from other relatives that it wasn't necessary to put dirty words in the book. And this poor old lady, she's very nice, I finally pinned her down. She had never said these words in her life, and I finally got her to admit, to distinguish. And I found out that it's all right, maybe, but you should never say. And I've been thinking about that ever since. I haven't been completely idle since completing my book, Slaughterhouse-Five. What I did is, and I would like to, there's news being made tonight because I haven't announced this before publicly, and one reason I want to announce it is to establish you, put you in condition to testify that this is actually a first for me and that you heard about this on November, what is this, the 6th? I think, see, now this story hasn't been published yet, but the story is written and accepted and everything. I think I am the first person to use the word in a title. I have written a story called The Big Space, and it's about this big see what it is. It's about the end of the world. Is the and it's about a couple living on the edge of Lake Erie there, and the all they're left are lampreys and and human beings, and they're turning into man-eating lampreys, and they the space program now has built this enormous spaceship, which they're going to send fire at the Andromeda Galaxy, which is 2 million light years away, and the hope is that human life will somewhere go on, because obviously the Earth is exhausted. And the name of this spaceship, which is an enormous thing, is the Arthur C. Clarke. And it's got a big warhead on it filled with sperm, you see. And they are firing this thing out there, hoping it'll hit something, you see, and life. Okay. As I started in this business while I was a public relations man at General Electric, at that time it was, this was, I don't know, 1950 as I became a freelance. At that time, there was a Saturday Evening Post, there was Liberty, there was Collier's, and they were all very hungry for stories. And if you could hack out something that looked like a story, you could sell it. Now, this industry no longer exists, which is too bad. Stories were heavily plotted then, and I was often considered writing a brilliant essay, and I understand that T.S. Eliot got credit for writing essays he'd only promised. So I will promise one showing that the popular plot forms in any civilization at any given time parallel exactly the conception of life on Earth and the life afterwards. And when I started writing, why, people still believed in heaven and insisted on happy endings on stories. And they don't insist on this anymore because they know God is dead. And if you read Indian legends, the stories the Indians told each other to amuse each other, the story is just linear. As the people go out to get food, and they go over a mountain, and they cross a river, and they find a deer, and they kill the deer, and they go on and on and on, and they're infinitely extensible, and they end anywhere with the words, "That is all," you see? And American stories are getting very much like that. So when I was teaching at the University of Iowa, most of the stories I got were about love in the English department, because that was all of all of life any of the students had seen. And I remember telling a student, "Hey, why don't you get out of here and do what American writers used to do, is get a job on a newspaper?" And he said, "'Cause I'll get drafted." And I said, "Okay, stay in here, it's all right." And all right, my academic training was, I have no college degree. And such training as I had was basically in chemistry, because my father wanted me to study something practical in college, something that would make me some money. And one advantage of not having taken anything past freshman English was that I did not have to learn good taste. And so that when I was writing badly, I thought it was pretty damn good. If I had been in the English department, and had written a story which was pretty good for a guy 19 years old, Professor Sweetbreads would have come over and said, "My boy, that's extremely interesting. Now I want to show you how Henry James handled exactly the same situation." Just, "Thanks a lot, you son of a bitch." You know, and on some level, they know what they're doing, too, is no English department has ever produced a writer. It's a pretty efficient system. I am interviewed constantly now, and they ask me what authors have inspired me most, and so I think up some. And then 2 days after the interview, I said, "God damn it, I forgot it again. It's Robert Louis Stevenson." And it's easy when to forget. But he's not a moldy fig. I'm so grateful for stories still, probably because I had a vested interest in them at one time. But Treasure Island is a beautifully made thing, and a charming put on, and Jekyll and Hyde is a splendid conception. It is a very good thinking about life. And that's what writing is about. It always has been sacred, and even if people don't intend it to be sacred, people who've just been born keep picking up books to find out how the hell you're supposed to live. And the bestsellers like The Exhibitionist and the Jacqueline Suzanne things are sacred books too. If you will look in them, you will find lessons on how the hell to act in a French restaurant. Do you tip? How do you get in and out of a gondola in case you ever go to Venice? Is what kind of drapes do movie stars have? What time do movie stars eat dinner? If you're, and so forth, because as people might have to decorate something nice sometime, as their fortunes might change, and these. These are lessons on how to live and are Bibles. There's a guy I always put at the head of my list of authors who've inspired me most is George Orwell. And I would like to be Orwell very much, except for one thing, that he's dead. And he apparently let himself die. There's an Orwell scholar here. I'd like to hear it denied, as my impression was that he declined to have his tuberculosis treated in any very effective way. Hemingway turned himself off with a double. I am now older than F. Scott Fitzgerald when he died. I'm older than D.H. Lawrence when he died. I'm older than George Orwell when he died. I'm 47. I'll soon be older than Jack Kerouac when he died. He was a couple of months older than I was. I knew Kerouac slightly. And I've wondered, of course, is why the hell authors die so young and even go to the trouble of turning themselves off. Just, it interests me as an actuarial problem, because that's a that's the trade I'm in. As Kerouac said, he busted himself with booze. It's just drank incredible amounts of alcohol till he had a massive hemorrhage and died a couple of weeks ago, a week and a half ago, not very long ago. Anyway, I've wondered why the hell he killed himself and why all these people kill themselves. And one thing is, I think that writers, creative writers, are in the process of becoming. They are humanity becoming. I think they draw on telepathic sources and so forth. But when you teach people who are not wanting to become hacks but are really trying to get something out of their system, it's like reaching into the mouth of the student and taking hold of a piece of tape in the back of the student's mouth without getting bitten and seeing what the hell's written on it, and then just keep pulling it out, and the person doesn't know what the hell it is. And I think it's a new message that somehow mankind, whatever, has conspired to deliver at this interface in time. And I think it becomes an exhausting thing to do. That's about it. A lot of people decline to do it anymore. It becomes too unpleasant. Just don't worry about me, I'm right. One bad thing is that speed works for writers. Because there never used to be anything that worked for writers that would help writers work better, but speed does for a little while. And most writers are drunks, and this is a business problem. This is an occupational hazard, is they can't work in the afternoons, most of them. And so they get plastered in order to turn themselves off. If they would legalize marijuana, they would save an awful lot of creative lives, I think. Is maybe our authors would live to be on the average of 52 or something like that. I haven't in my books handled women very well, and there are a couple of reasons for that. I'll give you an official one. The minute you talk about sex, you can't talk about anything else. And you might want to talk about some other aspect of life. And if you look in the works of Louis Fernand Céline or at Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, you will find that they both didactically at the beginning say, that isn't going to be the solution. It's not going to be a broad that's going to solve my particular angst. Because she can, you know. And the guy wants to tell another story. I came here with a paranoid announcement. I was going to say that I have appeared in the New York Review of Books only once in a paid ad. And then in the introduction, I learned that I had been mentioned. I was so pissed off at the thing, I stopped reading it and assumed they never would mention me. I have a friend, David Heyman, who's a critic out at the University of Iowa, and he's a Céline scholar, and he says that you probably can't be an important artist if you are not a paranoid. And there are reasons for this. This is not a joke or anything. He really means it. And the thing is, in order to sit alone and work all day long, you must overreact. You must be a terrible overreactor, and you're sitting there doing what paranoids do, is putting together clues, making them add up, you know. It's putting the fact that they put me into room 471, you know, and what does that mean and everything? Well, nothing means anything, as I've said, and as Beckett says, except there is this, the artist makes his living by pretending, by putting it in a meaningful hole, though no such holes exist, and it takes a paranoid mind to do this, and you need paranoia for energy, too. You must be terribly worried and secretly full of hate. When I've spoken to students, or one time I spoke to the Press Association, College Press Association, or some damn thing, and the speech obviously bombed. And I said, what the hell was the matter? And they said, well, we've gotten you out here to moralize, which is an old-fashioned word. So I moralize every time now, as I didn't really, you know, it's like asking, we had expected you to play the dulcimer or the sack butt. So it's some obscure medieval thing they'd hoped me to do. But anyway, so I do moralize, and I tell people is don't kill. Don't kill even in self-defense. Don't work on killing machines. Is don't litter, and don't take more than you need. And know you are going to die and think about it. And the reason I put that in there is that Slaughterhouse-Five is about how badly American prisoners of war behaved in the Second World War and again in the Korean War. As they let each other die, they were filthy, they wouldn't wash. And this was quite startling, as the other prisoners of war all survived much better than the Americans do. And so I reported this in my novel, and I heard from a lot of guys who had been in prison at the same time I was, who had seen this. And one guy said that the people he'd seen who had survived best were fundamentalists, as hillbillies and he supposed this was because they were used to the idea of death at coming to you at any time in a state of rest. And of course that's what prison is you're sitting there waiting. And what many people found demoralizing and finally shattering was that death could come at any time, as without any romance or excitement or anything else. And the fundamentalist knows at any moment he may die and God will take him back to heaven, and this has been told to him, and it isn't told to most of us. So let me tell you, you are going to die. And if you think about it from time to time, I think it would probably make you braver in jail. Is the Turks held up best of anybody in the prison camps in Korea, and they held hands and they hugged each other from time to time. I was thinking about the usefulness of love, and my favorite poem, or you know, the only poem I know, that's why it's a favorite one, is a William Blake thing. The angel that presided o'er my birth said, "Little creature born of joy and mirth, go love without the help of anything on earth. Go love without the help on anything of earth. There's no reason why you should love, but go do it anyway, see, and don't look for reasons." And that's what you do too, is writing schools are foolish, is again, go write without the help of anything on earth. Is how important my books are, or anybody's books are, I don't know. I don't think they're terribly important. I think that they make people contented during the period they're reading them. And this is something. This is worth something, is to take care of somebody for a couple of hours. And I think about getting through the Great Depression, and with my crazy mother and all that, it was Laurel and Hardy and W.C. Fields, as a word of honor, were the same in my life, as they sustained me thoroughly. And you will find people who are actually comforting millions. It's not within Nixon's power to do this, for instance, but it is within the Beatles' power. And there will always be magic entertainers who will comfort people some during the Job story that all our lives are. And for this reason, I honor my own profession, because we are entertainers, don't do a whole lot, but something. As I'm charmed to see people dressing in order to entertain each other, is to behave in ways, silly ways, to cheer each other up, as people are cheering up strangers by dopey little tricks that really don't take much talent, and life can become much more bearable on that account. And it isn't very hard.
Yeah. Kurt Vonnegut concluded his talk by literally pulling a bunch of yellow flowers from his sleeve. It was a lovely, sincere gesture, and the Vonnegut lovers enjoyed it thoroughly. This talk by the author of Cat's Cradle, Slaughterhouse-Five, and Player Piano was deeply enjoyed by those in attendance. Kurt Vonnegut is a wonderful man, and an equally wonderful author. This is Milton Hoffman.
We end this segment of From the Vault with Academy Award-winning actor Donald Sutherland reading an excerpt from Kurt Vonnegut's novel, Slaughterhouse-Five.
Slaughterhouse-Five, or The Children's Crusade. A Duty Dance with Death, by Kurt Vonnegut, Jr., a fourth-generation German-American, now living in easy circumstances on Cape Cod, and smoking too much, who, as an American infantry scout, hors de combat, as a prisoner of war, witnessed the firebombing of Dresden, Germany, the Florence of the Elbe, a long time ago, and lived to tell the tale. This is a novel somewhat in the telegraphic, schizophrenic manner of tales, of the planet Tralfamador, where the flying saucers come from. Peace. The cattle are lowing. The baby awakes. The little Lord Jesus, no crying he makes. All this happened, more or less. The war parts, anyway, are pretty much true. One guy I knew really was shot in Dresden for taking a teapot that wasn't his. Another guy I knew really did threaten to have all his personal enemies killed by hired gunmen after the war. And so on. I've changed all the names. I really did go back to Dresden with Guggenheim money, God love it, in 1967. It looked a lot like Dayton, Ohio. More open spaces than Dayton has. There must be tons of human bone meal in the ground. I went back there with an old war buddy, Bernard V. O'Hare, and we made friends with a cab driver who took us to the slaughterhouse where we had been locked up at night as prisoners of war. His name was Gerhard Müller. He told us that he was a prisoner of the Americans for a while, and we asked him how it was to live under communism, and he said that it was terrible at first, because everybody had to work so hard, and because there wasn't much shelter or food or clothing. But things were much better now. He had a pleasant little apartment, and his daughter was getting an excellent education. His mother was incinerated in the Dresden firestorm. So it goes. He sent O'Hare a postcard at Christmas time, and here is what it said. I wish you and your family, also as to your friend, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and I hope that we'll meet again in a world of peace and freedom in the taxi cab, if the accident will. I like that very much. If the accident will. I would hate to tell you what this lousy little book cost me in money and anxiety and time. When I got home from the Second World War 23 years ago, I thought it would be easy for me to write about the destruction of Dresden, since all I would have to do would be report what I had seen. And I thought, too, that it would be a masterpiece, or at least make me a lot of money, since the subject was so big. But not many words about Dresden came from my mind then. Not enough of them to make a book, anyway. And not many words come now, either, when I have become an old fart with his memories and his Pall Malls, with his sons full grown. I think of how useless the Dresden part of my memory has been, and yet how tempting Dresden has been to write about. And I am reminded of the famous limerick, "There was a young man from Stamboul who soliloquized thus to his tool. You took all my wealth and you ruined my health, and now you won't pee, you old fool." And I am reminded, too, of the song that goes, "My name is John Johnson, I work in Wisconsin, I work in a lumber mill there. The people I meet when I walk down the street, they say, 'What's your name?' And I say, 'My name is John Johnson, I work in Wisconsin.'" And so on to infinity. Over the years, people I've met have often asked me what I was working on. And I've usually replied that the main thing was a book about Dresden. I said that to Harrison Starr, the movie maker, one time, and he raised his eyebrows and inquired, "Is it an anti-war book?" "Yes," I said, "I guess." "You know what I say to people when I hear they're writing anti-war books?" "No." "What do you say, Harrison Starr?" "I say, why don't you write an anti-glacier book instead?" What he meant, of course, was that there would always be wars, that they were as easy to stop as glaciers. I believe that, too. And even if wars didn't keep coming like glaciers, there would still be plain old death.
You've been listening to From the Vault, an original Pacifica Radio Archives production created by Brian DeShazer and Christopher Sprinkle. From the Vault is broadcast throughout the Pacifica Radio Network with over 110 stations and affiliates. This program was produced by Mark Torres and Haunani Singer, executive producer Brian DeShazer, and the Pacifica Radio Archives. We are now streaming and podcasting online at fromthevaultradio.org. For more information, call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment of the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the University of California Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica Station listeners. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. I'm Haunani Singer. Thanks for listening.